Listen, did you know that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat? Yeah, disgusting, right? It can lead to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. It's just really gross. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth. They require up to 3 times less laundry, too, which who doesn't want less laundry? Miracle Made sheets have incredible self-cooling properties for better quality sleep. Their silver-infused fabrics are inspired by NASA, and they are thermoregulating. That means they are specifically designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. Say goodbye to gross odors with the sheets' self-cleaning properties. And I also have to say, they're super duper comfortable and they don't have the high price tag of some of the other brands. Also, it's allergy season, y'all. So I don't know if you're like me, but I'm looking for a springtime refresh in my house, and I think you deserve one too. So go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you are not 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you to Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and it is The Stacks Book Club Day. We are joined again by Ingrid Rojas Contreras, the author of The Man Who Could Move Clouds, and you can catch Ingrid's first appearance on the show back on our August 3rd episode. Ingrid is here to talk about our book club pick, which is How to Write an Autobiographical Novel, a collection of essays by Alexander Chi. It's Chi's own meditation on creating art, life, politics, and how all of that intersects with his identities as a gay Korean-American artist and activist. Through the collection, Ingrid and I talk about the relationship between the reader and the writer. We talk about what it means to live a life well-lived and how Chi cleverly can make just about anything about writing. Oh, and make sure you listen through the end of the episode to find out what our book club pick for September will be. Quick reminder, everything we talk about on each episode of The Stacks can be found in the link in the show notes. If you love this show and want more of it, head to patreon.com/thestacks to join the Stacks Pack. You'll get bonus episodes of the show, like our most recent one with author Tia Williams. You'll get access to our lively Discord community, discounts on merch, and of course, you'll get to be part of The Stacks monthly virtual book club. If those perks sound exciting to you, or you just really want to show your love for this little Black woman-run indie book podcast, head to patreon.com/thestacks to join. A quick thank you to our newest members of the Stacks Pack, Maria Andrea Belmont and Maya Wellbell. Thank you both so much, and thank you, as always, to the incredible, wonderful, extremely lovely Stacks Pack. And now it's time for my book club chat with Ingrid Rojas Contreras on Alexander Chi's collection of essays, How to Write an Autobiographical Novel. All right, everyone, it is the Stacks Book Club Day. I am joined again by the wonderful, talented, creative, exciting Ingrid Rojas Contreras, who is the author of The Man Who Could Move Clouds. Ingrid, welcome back to the Stacks.
Hi, so wonderful to see you twice in a row.
I know, it's a dream. So today is book club day. We're talking about How to Write an Autobiographical Novel by Alexander Chi. It's a collection of essays. I always forget to do this, so I'm trying to make a really good point of telling people what the book's about. It's a collection of essays about Alexander Chi's life and also about creating art and, in his case, writing. So it's sort of a guide to writing your own novel, if you will, but also just like approaching writing, and then also essays about his experiences from studying abroad in Mexico to planting a rose garden in New York City to being an activist during, you know, the AIDS crisis in San Francisco. So it's sort of a lot of different things. That's always my least favorite part of the episode. Okay. And then this is where we really get started. Just kind of briefly, will you tell me what you thought of this book?
Yeah, it's, I think that one of just hearing you describe it was making me look back and think about what I really loved about this collection of essays. And it is that sometimes, you know, like you read that essay about Alex Chi planting the rose garden, and you really kind of get into the roses and how is this garden going to look. And then eventually at some point, halfway through the essay, you start to realize that it is also about, it's an essay about making a life, which can also be like an essay about, you know, like how do you make space in the world? How do you want to be in the world? Like, what does that look like? And creative practice. So I feel like all of these essays are about finding yourself, and they're about, you know, how do you create your life? And that part of creativity that is also art making flourishes throughout the collection. And I just really love this book for that reason, because it just talks about life and creativity and just how the two can't be separated. So it's just something that I just really wowed me about this book. What about you? Okay. What did you think?
Okay. This is sort of a disclaimer, everybody. I am not a writer. I am shockingly not interested in writing. I'm not interested in the art process making as much as I'm interested in the art. Mm. So for me, this book was really hit or miss depending on the essay. Now, I want to say this very clearly. Alexander Chi is a fucking phenomenal writer.
Yes.
Because I was reading these essays, sitting there being like, I really don't care about this at all. And yet here I am, still deeply invested in how you're going to tell this story or how you're going to write. So for me, like, there were definitely essays that I really loved and connected to, but those were the ones that were more based on his experiences and his life and less like instructive about writing, less about like the decision to go to Iowa's writer's workshop. Like, it doesn't mean anything to me. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, I know what you mean.
So it was a difficult read, because while I liked the writing and I liked a lot of the essays, some of them I was like, I'm so bored here because this is just not a thing that I'm curious about. And I'll be really excited to hear what people listening to the show think, because I know so many people are writers or are interested in the actual writing process in a way that, I know this is going to sound weird, I'm just not, even though I talk much about the process.
Yeah, I get that. And I think that with this book, it's trying to imagine what talking about writing could look like, and that it's not a full, like, this is how you create a novel, or, you know, like talking about craft in that way. But it is still kind of a craft book. And then instead it's talking about creative process and life. Yeah. So I wonder if those parts of the book that you were kind of like losing interest in, probably, I think those are geared for the writer,
the craft
audience
side.
Who is like reading and who is wondering, how does it all happen and what does it look like and what is the life like, I think.
Yeah. How many times have you read this book?
Probably 3 times, I would say.
And when you read it for the first time, had you published any books yet?
Yes, I had published my novel by the time that I read it. Yeah, and I think the first time that I read it, there's like a chapter that's called How to Write an Autobiographical Novel. No, wait, it's a later one, but it's like the list of
100 things about writing a novel.
Yeah. And that one just like really, How to Write an Autobiographical Novel. And then it just, it lists all, it's like on page 244, and it just lists all kinds of things about what it means when you're writing a novel and you're borrowing from life. And there was this line that just like really hit me. And it's just like the end of that part. Ready to steal as much of your life as you let them, more than what they already have taken. One last price hidden behind the rest. Write fiction about your life and pay with your life at least 3 times. Here is the axe. I just like really felt that, and just coming from having written a novel that was autobiographical, and how strange it is that you borrow from life and then you end up, you know, and it's fiction, but you actually end up putting so much truth in the in the novel. I felt like, yeah, that part just like really, I remember reading that and just like sitting there for a while, like taking that in.
That's the thing I really want to talk about is writing fiction about your life, taking things from your life. And then the thing that was really interesting to me, it was in the other one, the autobiography of my novel, which was a little bit earlier. And he talks about, you know, this whole process. And at the end, he talks about this prisoner who like has written to him because his autobiographical novel is Edinburgh. And it's about, you know, a young person who is molested, and it's like kind of like layers on layers, but the person who wrote to him as a prisoner who was in jail for having molested a child. And Alex says, you know, they took something from the novel that was different than what I had intended. And so I'm really curious about that for you and a person who's also written this like sort of autobiographical novel. What's it like when someone takes from your book not what you had hoped or intended they would take from your book?
I think that for me, like the comments that I receive for it, where it feels like it's not what I intended, are when people tell me that they've learned so much about Colombia, as if the novel was kind of like a history book, or as if it was there to kind of like educate them. It doesn't bother me that someone, you know, because of course that would happen, that you write a book and then different people are just going to get different things from it. But it is very different than what I wanted the reader to walk away from, to walk away with from reading the novel. And I wrote it trying to understand, you know, what is like this very complicated relationship that you can have with someone in a country that's been, at war for decades, and what happens when that violence kind of creeps in and gets closer and then poisons that relationship, and then what happens to those two people. And that's what I was trying to study and look at and to really explore with the novel. And it was, you know, something that, because, you know, that novel is also autobiographical for me, and it involves a kidnap and an attempted kidnapping, that it was just like really hard for me to go there, right? And so then you have this whole personal experience alone in your room where you're like doing this hard thing, and then you publish, and then someone says, I learned so much about the history, you know, just it's just like not quite what you were like okay.
Right. So in the one that you mentioned, How to Write an Autobiographical Novel, the first line is, you only tell the truth. That's the first sentence of that essay. And, you know, as a person who certainly loves art in all and most different forms, and, you know, like thinks about art and likes to talk about art and critique art and all of these things, I was really struck by that sentence because I kept thinking, like, what does that even mean in art? What does telling the truth even mean in art? Like, isn't part of art that you're allowed not to tell the truth, or that you're supposed to not tell the truth, or that even in nonfiction, like that there's some rendering of the world through the artist's viewpoint? And that really struck me. And then I started thinking, like, can I tell when a book is not being truthful? Not that the facts are untrue, but like that it's not actually true to the to the author. And like, and I wonder, like, how do you even, like, for me, not that I'm like an artist, but for this show, there are definitely interviews on this show or episodes of this show where I know that I was faking the funk, where like I wasn't being truthful, or like I wasn't really locked in the way that I feel is truth-like. And I don't always know that I'm doing it until I listen back, or like I don't always know, but I think about writers, and you have an editor and you have this other person who's telling you what they're getting from it. Is it hard to tap into the truthy part? Is it hard to like stop lying to yourself? Like, how does that work?
It is. Yeah, I think it is really hard. Alex G in this book, I think the first essay talks a lot about seeing yourself.
The one about being in Mexico.
And it's, I think...
The curse.
Yeah, the curse. And it's, I think, an essay at some point where he says, I was a boy who was trying to lose himself in other people as a way to see himself. So I think that kind of self-awareness, both to really understand, you know, how you're living your life, and what the hidden part of what you're doing. I think that's the really hard part to do. But I do think that whether it's fiction or nonfiction, that as a writer, you absolutely need to have that kind of self-awareness. And when it,
How do you get it?
I think that it's, I think that you don't look away, you know, so like the parts when you, in those kind of uncomfortable moments where you're like, oh, I'm catching myself being vain in this moment, we tend to just kind of shut it down and just like not look any further. You kind of try to forget about it. And I feel in your brain what we want to do is to say anyway, and then you know, move on. So I think I think this is just good training too, to be a person in the world where, and for writers, I think it's so crucial because it allows you to write the truth, to just linger in those moments, actually. So like to note your own discomfort as you're going through the world and you notice something about yourself, and to not look away. And maybe, you know, maybe in that moment we look away, but later when we're able to really look at that moment and really kind of think about it. Yeah. And I, with fiction, the part about the truth is so interesting because in Alex Chi talks about how he, you know, I think he's referencing at some point he's in a book club or a book meeting, and someone asks him, why, if this is autobiographical, why didn't you write it as memoir?
Right.
And he's very confused by that question. And he later says, I write fiction because it's the things that I can't say in my life. Right. And so he's also, I think he was also talking about Lori Moore and how she was talking about the comfort of the mask. And I think fiction can be that. It's a type of writing that allows you to put on a mask or allows you to make space for the things that you can't say in your actual life. And so you need this other way of talking about it. And then you can tell the truth. So it is kind of like truth via a mask. But oftentimes it's like the only way that you can tell it or that you're comfortable telling it.
Right. It's like the Halloweenification of writing. You know, it's like people who like love Halloween because they get to like put on a costume and like act freaking crazy because they can't do it in their life.
Yeah.
It's like then you get to like tap into like whatever, you know, instincts or primal feelings or whatever it is on Halloween.
Yeah.
Which is why I hate Halloween. I'm like, ugh, get a grip. Go to therapy.
What is your did you ever have a favorite costume that you had?
Gosh, no. I have dressed up for Halloween like twice in the last. My favorite costume, so I have 2-year-old twins, and for their first Halloween, I dressed them up as the two popes, like that movie when there was two popes. Uh-huh. And so that was
really
iconic to me. Got a lot of laughs. So that's that was a good one. But I haven't dressed up in 10 years, probably.
Yeah.
I'm just not into it. I always tell people, I think part of it is I went to theater school. So
I
grew up dressing. I was an actress. I was a dancer. We always wore costumes. So for me, Halloween's just like a chore.
Yeah. I understand that.
As a kid, though, I was a hula dancer like 3 times, really into it. Pre-cultural appropriation days, when I didn't know that like now I'd get in trouble. I was like 7, and my dad would make me wear, because I'm from Oakland, it's cold in Halloween, make me wear a white turtleneck underneath my like coconut bra. Uh-huh. So all the pictures are really good. Do you have a favorite Halloween costume?
I think the last one that I did was I dressed this AOC and I wanted genius. It to be like the Republican nightmare. And that's what I was going for.
You probably looked a lot like her. You did like
I do. It was
like
very easy. It was very easy to transition into her look.
yeah, that's a good one. I've always wanted to be Lisa Turtle from Saved by the Bell. That's one that I always say I'm gonna do and I never do, and make my husband be Screech because he's a white boy.
Yeah.
But I don't know. One year, maybe. Anyways, really got off topic. I love it here. Okay, I want to stay on this topic of like the reader and the writer, because I feel like that was like what was most interesting to me as the reader, and obviously you're a writer. One of the things that like I talk about a lot is the review, like the review of the book, of the art, and how I think that the review is not for the author. It's like the least for the author of all people. And I'm wondering like what I want to know if you read reviews, first of all, and I want to know like how you negotiate that feedback when your work is in the world, because it might be valuable in some ways, but also like there's not a lot you can do about it. It's published, it's done. So I'm sort of wondering about your relationship to reviews.
I do read reviews. I used to write reviews a lot. I was the book columnist for KQED, which is a local and NPR place. And one of the things as I started to write reviews is that I really like the reviews that are completely personal and don't try to pretend that it's an objective, you know, this is like my objective opinion of this book and I'm going to pretend, I'm going to write it like it's the truth. What I'm writing is the truth. And I really loved writing reviews that were kind of like half essay, half reviews. So they were about like, this is what's happening in my life. And this is what when I read that line, I was in the train and this is what happened. And so I think that feels more honest to me too, because the way that wherever you are in your life and whatever is happening around you as you're reading something affects how you're reading that book.
Right.
So, so I think through that experience of just writing reviews for many years that I can read a review and not take it personally. Or I can read a review and just take it as like, oh yeah, this is this one person's opinion of this. And I think that what I also agree with you that it's not for me, that it's not, that this is not a thing that's for me, but it's more a conversation that maybe I can listen in on if I want to about what is being said. And as you read more and more reviews, you start to get this sense of like, oh, this is kind of the conversation that is arising. And I think if there's like multiple reviews that are saying like, this is a problem, then I think maybe that's something to look at. And then otherwise you might just get a lot of reviews that are like, I didn't like this. And then someone else might say like, I love this part. And so then that tells you that the book has a very specific audience and that the book is not for everyone. And I think books are not for everyone. If like a single book was made to be read by, I don't even know what that would be. It would just be like a blank book.
It would be like the alphabet or something. Yeah. Like not even. Interesting. Were you, when you reviewed for them, was it anonymous?
No, I put my name on it and everything.
Did you ever feel stressed out about having to write or like writing something about negative things about a book?
If I felt too negative about a book, I just wouldn't write a review. And I was just often thinking about how much of, you know, when a book is published, how much of a miracle that feels like, because it's so hard from, you know, conception until it's published. And then everything else is just so difficult about that. That I didn't feel like if I just was not into a book, that I just wouldn't review it. And it would have to be that the book was doing something politically questionable that I would write a review about it then, just because I felt like then it's something that needs to be said.
Right, right.
That doesn't have to do with me just not liking the book.
Right.
Yeah.
When you hear back from people at book events or a review or whatever, and they, like, how important is it to you that the reader gets what you're trying to do? Because, like, I think a lot about, like, reading in school, and, like, it'd be like, oh, we're reading One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And then the teacher would be like, the author is clearly, like, do-do-do-do-do-do, like some theme. And every time you see a bed sheet, it means rebirth or whatever, something crazy. Yeah. And you spend a whole semester like digging into these like little nuggets. In doing this podcast, I have found out that a lot of authors, that is like made up, that like a lot of those things are not the authors like doing it on purpose. It's like an accident that people read into. And then some of it is on purpose. But like, how important is it to you that like we see what you're doing, that we understand like the theme or like the little nuggets and stuff? Or is that for you?
I think it's fun. It's really fun when somebody notices. Mm-hmm. I think when my novel came out, one of the things that I hadn't talked about yet in public was my process, and that I was doing an internal transliteration in order to write the language so that it felt like on the inside internally it was Spanish and that on the outside it was English. So I was trying to use like Spanish grammatical structure. I see. I was trying to kind of like push the grammar of English so that it kind of sounded like Spanish. You would only know this if you spoke both languages well.
Right.
And yeah, so I was going about tour, and then there was this one woman who told me, like, pulled me aside and told me, like, okay, when I was reading the book, it was like, these are thought in Spanish, but you're like translating them and writing them into English. And I was just like so overjoyed that she had noticed this, and I was it was like the best thing that happened that month. I was like, oh my god, like someone got this thing. I don't think that I need anybody, you know, everyone to notice, but it felt like very good when this one person noticed that.
I love that. Okay. Okay. Wait, I want to get back to the book because I'm like going deep dive on all these things that came, like a lot of this stuff came up for me as I was reading it, though it's not like expressly in the book. But yeah. I just was like, what the book made me think about was how much like thinking Alexander Chi does about writing and like how intense he is about his intentions for his work. And like his, and some of it is, I'm like thinking, is he thinking this before he's writing, or is he realizing this is what he's done after he's written the thing? Mm-hmm. Which to me, I work more the second way. Like I'll do something and then I'll be like, oh, I did this. That was because, you know, but all of that is really interesting to me. And so a lot of questions came up, but there's also all these other essays, which I'm now realizing hearing you talk about, they're like about other things that have to do with writing. But like, I didn't really pick up on that. I'm like, these are just really good stories. But my favorite essay was After Peter, the one about his friend and like one time lover who passed away from AIDS. And your book does this. There are a few books or writers who do this, but when a writer can capture a loved one, especially someone who's passed away, I think that that is truly my favorite genre of writing. Mm. Like when they can capture the essence of this person and explain to us why they're important without being like, Peter was like this and was so important to me.
Right.
Like your grandfather, who you didn't spend much time with on this earth, is such a huge character in your book. Mm-hmm. And like, we fall in love with him because you love him.
Right.
And like, that's the same thing with Peter. It's like, I was so taken by that essay from the beginning. I just was like, I love Peter. Mm-hmm. And I miss Peter. And like, I don't know, that for me, that was like the big like essay that really made me be like, holy shit, Alexander Chi is a master of like writing.
I love that essay. And I feel like it's a very beautiful essay, and the way that it's layered to me is so wonderful, because it is about this relationship to this to a person who was like a once lover, a friend, who is dying and is not kind of sharing that with people. And then it's also, I think, you know, the essay is kind of thinking about memory and, you know, sharing life with someone. And I don't know if it's in that essay or in other essays, but the idea of writing as a way to, you know, have something have a little bit of immortality so that it can mm-hmm. kind of be like saved and passed on. Yeah. And I think the first time that we see Peter, it's also like a just a really beautiful, very kind of stunning description of someone.
Yeah. And the idea of like how it's like sort of about legacy, right? Like how does someone live on? And what came to me when reading this one towards the end was like, there's no way that Peter could have known what he meant to Alexander Chi, especially like all these years after his death, that he would be this figure in this book about writing and craft and mm-hmm. art. And like, I wonder if like Alexander Chi made a big enough impression on Peter that he would have ever even imagined that this thing was possible. And I just, it like makes me sad and really happy. And like, it just like, you know, that feeling of like when you have a lot of feelings and like you feel it like coming up behind your eyes and like in your chest, it gives me that feeling of like overcomeness by who we each like get to be mm-hmm. and how the small figures in our life can become very important to us, or how we become important to other people, or like how one person's path that crosses yours can become like some sort of a muse. There's just like so much in this one. And then there's also like the politics in this one that I really loved, and like seeing it obviously in this time of COVID and now monkeypox, and like seeing what they were going through and how they were dealing with loss, and like how we are and aren't dealing with loss now. And like, this one just was like so, so full. And then, this is like a little anecdote, but we have a family friend who's like an older white guy who mm-hmm. watches Bill Maher, which it tells you exactly who that person is. And we were talking about, I don't remember what, and he was saying how he was watching some gay man on Bill Maher talk about how, you know, the trans activists are hurting gay people. Uh-huh. Because they want all people to say the right pronouns, and they're really pushy and they're mean and they're aggressive. And that he said that, you know, the gay rights movement was always about being funny, and we were always like down for a laugh and a good time. And when this person told me this, I obviously was like, that's so fucking ahistorical. This is bullshit. It's homophobic. I hate it. Or it's transphobic. I hate it. Whatever. And then later that week, I read this essay, and it was like a reminder that, A, there was so much rage, as there is in all of these movements, but also that's good, like that's the right response. And like being funny or whatever this guy was saying is not real, and it's so ahistorical. It made me so mad. But yeah. I loved reading about this moment, because I was like, I knew when I heard that it was wrong. But then reading this one and 1989, the other essay, I was mm-hmm. like, this shit is like, the fact that people are allowed to forget all of this and pretend yes. like it was just like gay people were funny and they were in musicals. It's like, yeah. No, gay people were dying and devastated and in a rage, as they should be. And it wasn't just gay men, you know, yeah. like yeah. the gay rights movement wasn't just gay men. It was trans people. I don't know. The whole thing made me so mad. And this essay just felt so like validating in a lot of ways. So I love Peter.
Yeah. I loved reading too, just all about the protesting and all the actions that mm-hmm. were being taken alongside with, you know, like, the having lovers and like dressing up and mm-hmm. going yeah, out
girl
yeah, because I think you really, as a reader, it really feels like you can step into what that time was like. Yes. And as you're saying, like, you can really feel the rage. And I found myself admiring the actions that they were taking. Mm-hmm. And I think this was when, was it through ACT UP that the political actions were being taken? And there's
some of it was, and then some of it was like other groups, because other ACT UP was like, we can't do that. And they were like, okay, we'll just make this other group called Smacked UP and we'll do it.
But that one where they in San Francisco, like they printed the first page of what would like a mock-up of the Chronicle. And then instead they're saying like how many people have died, in the AIDS crisis. And they were there, but they were kind of like, I think he described the image as like it was made to look like it was a disaster happening. And they paid for the to open like the newspaper box and then, you know, put that front page sheet over the actual newspaper and then put it back. And I loved reading about that moment so much and all of the other actions, the political actions that were being taken. Because I think that it just really allows you to see like all that we're not doing yet.
Yeah.
You know, like all that.
Yeah.
Or just gives you that imagination of, you know, we have injustices and we have also the power to dream up like how are we gonna, what are we gonna do and what does that look like? And you know, so it's so wonderful to me that you're, that this is a collection of essays that is about writing and art making, but it's so much, you know, about life and,
I think ultimately, right, that's the point of the essay collection, is that you can do all the writing stuff and you can, you know, take a class and you can get a master's and you can do all these things. But if you don't live a life that's full of people and things and you aren't able to see the world, and like for example, the Rose essay, I did not care for that one. It was a little too in the weeds.
I love that one. See what I did there?
Oh my God. No, I was not into it. I was not into it. But I respect that essay because he really took a garden and wrote like 50 pages about it and like could see all these pieces, right? And like that is fodder for his work, right? Like, because I think so many people think to be an artist, you have to be focused only on the art. And this book shows that like there is no Alexander Chi without the work that he did in activism or being in the bookstore or going to Mexico on this exchange visit, right? That all of that is the, you know, to carry on the Rose metaphor, all of that is the soil from which the essays grow. Mm-hmm. And I just think like, I mean, I don't know. I'm sure this has always been true in all times when people were creating, but it feels to me so much right now that people are so like sub-specialized and focused on the work that they do that they don't realize like that you have to also go live. You also have to like experience to really understand if you want to create, if you want to make things, like you can't just sit at the computer.
Yeah.
That's not actually the job. The job is to live and interpret and then create the thing.
Yeah.
So like the essays that I didn't care for as much, like about his life, I still was really like intrigued by them because I was like, oh, you're doing things here with these roses. But I don't care about roses.
Can I tell you what I love about that one essay?
Yes, of course.
I think that this is an essay where when I first read it, I wasn't super interested in roses as well. And now anytime that I see a rose, I can't but like but think of this essay and Alex G. What I love about this essay is just that, you know, it's building a garden in a time of flight, in a time of his life where Alex G feels a little bit lost. And it's kind of like trying to root down. And it's just kind of like a creation of space, and trying to kind of like claim space. And then there's this thing about looking at the word rosary and how it initially meant like a rose garden, and now it means prayer. And to me, there's a way in which we're talking about roses, but we're just talking about writing. Mm-hmm. And how when you, you know, like whatever, when you do like a practice like writing where it involves so much energy and it involves so much internal work that is invisible, it, you know, starts to feel like it's that kind of repetitive prayer-like activity that you're doing. Right. And one of the things that I loved after like reaching the end of the essay was like the how it ends. He, you know, he has to like move away from that apartment building and like the roses behind. And he just kind of like feels very bad about like leaving them. And he has this, he's like moves across the city and he says like, I can feel them still, the sap pulsing in their veins, pushing their way to the sky. But the creature that grew legs and walked away from the garden was me. I was not their gardener. They were mine. And I love this idea of some of the things that you do in your life, you think that you're the active doer of those things when those things are tending after you. And I find that it's the same way when you're writing a book. At times it feels like you're just creating this book and you're creating this material. Yeah, you feel like you're creating something, and then there's a way in which the book ends up changing who you are. So in a way, like the book ends up kind of changing you. So it's just like, I love the way that the rose garden, thinking about roses and then thinking about like what are ways in which you can kind of make your life and make it kind of a beautiful place for you to be there. I just feel like that essay does all of it. It just like thinks about how to build space, how to like tend to your imagination, how to like lose yourself in an obsession, and then how to like allow that to change you. It's just also so beautiful. I love that we like have such different.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think that's what's cool about this book is like, even if you're like me or not a writer, like there's different ways to enter this book, like different, I feel like different essays are going to speak to you. I also think the reason I asked how many times you've read it is I feel like different essays probably speak to you each time in a different way because they're like so vast. And, you know, I was also really struck by, well, actually, let's take a quick break. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for more than 3 years, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. At 52 iterations of their formula and counting, their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and aim to find the best quality ingredients available. Look, there's a reason I keep AG1 in my own morning routine. That's quality. For AG1, it isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because it's NSF certified for sport, one of the most rigorous independent quality and safety certification programs in the supplement industry. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated, and AG1 simplifies this by making it so there aren't a million different pills and capsules for me to keep track of. It's just one scoop of AG1 mixed in water every day. It could not be simpler. AG1's ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes folate, magnesium, and ashwagandha for stress support. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely looked forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out. Okay, microdosing. Have you tried it yet? I know a lot of folks swear by it. You should know that all sorts of people are microdosing to feel healthier and perform better. Microdose gummies deliver perfect entry-level doses of THC that help you feel just the right amount of good. Whether you're a creative or you're super active, microdosing is for all walks of life. And that goes for people who are curious or longtime fans. These gummies get you right in that sweet spot where you're totally at peace after a workout or a shower or deep in the zone of a project. They're amazing for long hikes or just decompressing with a book under the covers, and they taste as good as they feel. Plus, if you're struggling at all with sleep or joint pain, they'll help with that too. Just take a gummy 1 hour before you want to fall asleep. We're all looking for ways to stay centered and in the moment, but keep our sharpness while in the creative flow or tackling day-to-day work. Microdose gummies are a great way to get that perfectly balanced effect. Even a quarter or half a gummy can go a long way. Get 30% off your first order plus free shipping today at microdose.com, promo code THESTACKS. It's available nationwide. That's microdose.com, promo code THESTACKS for 30% off and free shipping. Microdose.com, promo code THESTACKS.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about all from the comfort of your home isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, we're back. I'll tell you now. I was really struck by how many jobs he'd had.
Yes.
Has had. Because I always joke that I'm a person with no career, but with have had many jobs. And I sort of like say that in a self-deprecating way. But I was like, Alexander Chee's like a serious person. And look at all the jobs he's had. And like, he still's a serious person. So that's wonderful for him and for me as inspiration. But it was like, he was a cater waiter. He was, you know, he's a teacher, he's a writer, he was like doing just like a million things. I just thought it was so, so fantastic. Did you have a, do you have, is the rosary one your favorite? Or do you have a different one that's your favorite?
Let me look at the, I also really love, I mean, I love Girl, and the Querent, which is the tarot one.
Oh my God, that's the other one I hated.
That's the other one you hated.
Yeah, I hated that one.
I think maybe for that
one. I have to
one,
be honest, I don't think I finished it.
Yeah, I think for that one, maybe you have to be into tarot. Because otherwise, yeah, it's just like, the, you know, he's just describing cards and you're like, I don't know what this means. But for
that's
me,
exactly
I'm
right.
Like, oh, I know exactly what this means. And I, yeah, I have like a different entry into that one.
So that one's not about anything bigger. It's just about tarot. I mean, I was hoping you would explain it to me.
I think I've tried this where he says, well, so that one is about, I think it's about wanting to know the future and how that can kind of come from a place of fear, but how wanting to know the future is its own obstacle. Like it means that you actually start to tamper with your future by being kind of like actively trying to predict it. And yeah, I think it's also like a little bit about writing in the way that when you write fiction, sometimes you're writing into a life that you didn't live or like what could have happened. Sometimes it's like it starts with what happened and then it goes into what could have happened. And it's a little bit of, it does feel like a little bit of fortune telling where you're trying to see someone's life and trying to understand everything about them.
Yeah.
So I really kind of like see a connection between when you're trying to give someone a reading and you don't know anything about their lives, but you have these cards and then you try to tell them a story from what you see in front of you. And I think that's very similar, has a very similar energy to like when you sit down to write and you are trying to think of a character and you're trying to imagine what it is in their lives that is turmoil or like what are the new things that are coming in and what are the things that are leaving them. So yeah, so I think all of the essays are about writing, but it's just, you know, in the background they're about writing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so, yeah, some of them. And then some of them are, it's definitely in the foreground.
Yeah.
In the essay, The Writing Life, where he talks about his like fancy teacher in college whose class he goes to, and she gives him all the things. I loved this idea of where she says, you know, put all your deaths and your accidents up front where possible. I just love where possible. I don't know. I'm such a rule follower and I'm not a where possible person. I'm a very like, it needs to happen here. But where possible just feels so great. I don't know why, but it's like we can't always follow the guidelines. Yeah. Are you a rule follow-y person?
No, I am not. And I am also, when I teach, I also, you know, add things like this may or may not apply to you or to what you're writing.
Are you into your horoscope?
Into my horoscope. I used to be. Are you?
I was just curious what sign you are.
I'm a Virgo sun.
But not rule following. This is
Gemini
news.
Rising.
Which, okay. There it is.
An Aries moon. So I feel like, those two are just like not.
Interesting.
Yeah, but I think, you know, it's just that when you have rules, I just don't think that it applies to all kinds of cultures storytelling. So like, I think that if you come from another culture, that probably you're breaking a lot of the rules, which are made for another culture. So I just think it's just hard. It's, you know, like you can't write the book that is for everyone. You can't have rules that will apply to everything. It's just like not possible.
Right. Did you find, like you were saying, how you were, you know, playing with language in ways in your novel? And we talked last time about sort of the structure of your book and kind of staying true to this Colombian cultural storytelling. Do you find that people were asking you to conform your work into an American palette? That's very air quotes-y. Like, did you run up against this thing of like, no, I'm trying to do this. This is the way I'm trying to tell the story. It comes from like my Colombian experience, culture, upbringing, everything. And people are being like, but in America, we do this. Like, did you have to deal with that at all?
I think I had to deal with that. I think when I was a student.
Did you get an MFA?
I got an MFA and I went to Columbia College in Chicago. And I think that in when I would bring a story to workshop and it would be set in Colombia, the feedback that I would get on a story was like, what is this food that you mentioned? Or like, what is the weather in the thing? Or like in this place? Or like, I don't know where this is. Can you say where this is? And so I think that just very quickly kind of taught me how writing is actually very political, and how when you have a reader who is outside from the culture and is kind of like insisting for you to bring the story to them or to like translate it and make it specifically for them, how that's something that happens a lot. And it is a political decision to say, no, you come to the story, right? Like,
right.
I'm going to keep the center where it is, and you like the reader needs to come to it. But I think over time, I learned that if you just describe the work in that way and you just say that at the beginning, whether it's in the classroom or whether it's you're like, you know, trying to place something with a magazine or you're trying to like get an agent or talk to an editor about possibly doing something, that if you say that at the beginning, that it tends to not be an issue, because then people it's like you're telling someone like, this is how you're supposed to read it. And this is the political kind of stance that this work is taking. And then I feel that after that, people are excited about it. Like, it's almost like giving someone a key, like, this is, so it's not going to be what I'm used to. It's going to be something else. And I think most people are very, do want to have a different experience reading.
Well, and I feel like for me, like I don't, I I would rather have a different experience reading than read something that feels like a circle stuffed into a triangle. You know what I mean? Like, I would, like, I just rather read a circle and just say it's a circle.
Totally.
I'm capable of engaging with all sorts of shapes, you know?
Yeah.
Like, but when you try to jam it in there, then it feels like I hate in books where it's like, you know, we had like cornbread, and then like cornbread is an African-American delicacy, you know, like grown from corn on the plantation and eaten off. I'm just like, I don't need all that. I have Google. Like, thank you. Yeah. Thank you. The thing, oh my gosh. Wait, one of the things in this book that was like mind blowing was when I think it's in the autobiography of my novel where Alexander talks about being his agent or his editor being like, you could be the first Korean American novelist. Mm-hmm. And then he's like, then Chang Rae Lee like wrote his book. So then I was the first gay one in 1995. And I was like,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Like, it's just not, it doesn't feel like it's that long ago.
It's not that long ago. Like, this is our, yeah, like our, all of the books that we're having that are diverse and that are doing all of those things are, you know, not very, yeah, it wasn't that long ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like that there wasn't an Alexander Chi for Alexander Chi is just like a wild thought to me, you know, like, mm-hmm. I don't know. I know it. Like, we get reminders constantly, especially like with the Oscars or like the Emmys, like first blank to be nominated in blank. But to think about it, like, it's just really, it's like very jarring. Mm-hmm. It also made me think about like white people who write, like having so much less anxiety about their work or like having or about anything that they create or write or make, because like there's so much more room to fail because there isn't that pressure of like representing an entire group of people.
Yeah.
And what you're talking about, like not having to like give a pre-claimer to your work by being like, this is going to be different than what you've experienced, person with a small mind. Like, just all of that is just like so, I mean, it's frustrating.
It is frustrating.
And also like illuminating about where we are now, that we're not so far away from that.
Yeah. And I think this is what allows some writers to say that their work isn't political.
Right.
You know, just because you... all of that means is that you just don't have a political consciousness. Like, you're not seeing...
You have no relationship to history.
Yeah, you're not seeing how you're fitting into the politics of storytelling.
Or you are seeing it, but you don't want to admit that it makes you a bad guy.
Yeah. I think it is for writers of color, any, you know, minority writer, that you do have to think about it and you do have to make that part of the conversation. But I don't know. I really look forward to the day when we don't have to have, you know, flags anymore about work that is deviating from the traditional thing, and that we can be in this excitement over different styles and not need someone to be a tour guide, you know, of their experience or the world that they're writing about.
Right. And also, like, part of me also feels like we do need tour guides always, because like we've lived different lives and had different experiences, but that can be, like, right now to me, it feels like when an author of color, like a Black author, writes and I can tell that it's like written for a white audience, that like makes me burn on the inside. Mm-hmm. It makes me very upset. And I'm hopeful that one day, if a Black author chooses to write for a white audience, that that's okay too. You know?
Yeah.
Like that they should, like that they could be allowed to do that, and that I could find that work valuable and not find that work dehumanizing. But like where we are right now, because it's so political.
Yeah.
It feels like that choice to write for white people is like somehow a choice to like turn your back on me, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I hope that, like, you know, to your point, we don't need tour guides. And if we have them, it's like a creative choice and not a like industry choice or something that's forced on them to like sell books or whatever.
To make
that
it
is
more
palatable
or so that readers can connect to it.
Yeah. All the stupid things. And it's like, I don't know, as a like whenever I read those kind of books, I am instantly like, oh, they're writing for white people. Like you can just, you feel it. That's the truth.
Yeah.
That truth and lying in the writing that we were talking about earlier. Like that's that feeling to me where I'm just like, ugh, this is bullshit.
Exactly.
And we all know it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then of course those books are like Reese Book Club picks and all the things.
I know.
They make me rage on the inside.
Yeah.
Okay. We're running out of time. I feel like we almost touched on every single one. We missed a few, but we'll just, sorry, everyone. We're just going to miss a few. Okay, so we usually end here, which is, what did you think? What do you think of the cover and the title?
Ooh, I think that this is a beautiful cover. Oh yeah, we have the same one.
We have this. I think there's only the one. I think it did it come out in hardcover? I think it was only a paperback.
I'm not sure.
I don't know. It's red. It has a picture of a young Alexander Chi, sort of looking at the camera, sort of saying like, "I dare you to fuck with me," maybe, or also sort of saying like, "I'm a sad boy," or like he's saying nothing and everything.
It's saying so much. Yeah.
Yeah. And then
then you open it and there are all of these photos that are, you know, from like a strip at a photo booth, it looks like. And it's just like such a good, I love this design. And you flip to the back and also like the flap in the back also has more. And I just really love that as a design. I felt like it was just so striking.
Yeah. I love seeing the young Alexander Chi, like the person that we hear about, you know, and like seeing this young man in the stories.
Yeah. There's something so intimate about being in a photo booth.
Yeah. Alone in all of them.
Yeah.
Too.
And you know that you have like, however, like many 5 seconds to like do something else for your next photo. Yeah. I always love them. I think that they're such a great portrait of a person. Like what all those decisions of 5 seconds, like what you will do next. I feel like they say so much.
That's so true. And then the title is just one of the titles of one of the essays. And I think it's a good title for what this is.
It tells you that it's going to be a book about writing and that it's a little bit of a how-to.
And that there's autobiography inside.
And that there's autobiography. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it's a pretty spot on package for me. Like, you know, the red is good. Like a red book always catches your eye, you know, like it's a very well done, like sleek little moment. So I love that. Was there anything else we did not talk about that you feel like we absolutely can't leave here without talking about?
Can I read a little bit of the ending? I love the ending so much.
Yes. I feel like we have to talk about the last essay for a second. Yeah. Go ahead.
Speak to your dead, write for your dead. Tell them a story. What are you doing with this life? Let them hold you accountable. Let them make you bolder or more modest or louder or more loving, whatever it is, but ask them in, listen, and then write. And when war comes, and make no mistake, it is already here, be sure you write for the living too, the ones you love and the ones who are coming for your life. What will you give them when they get there? I tell myself I can't imagine a story that can set them free. These people who hate me, but I am writing precisely because one did that for me. Yeah. And I love that, you know, as a parting kind of gift and thought. And I know that we were talking about this in our last chat together about thinking of yourself as part of a larger context and how that means looking to the past and then looking present and then to the future as well. Yeah, I just love that line so much, or those lines together.
Yeah. And like, again, this, like we were talking about last time, this responsibility to the dead, you know, in this essay, he talks about, you know, what stories would you write for the dying? And if you were dying, what stories would you want to be told or tell? And I just think like, again, I mean, all of this sort of circles back, right? Like that it is political, that it is a choice, that your life is meaningful and it's your responsibility to tell these stories and be responsible to these people that you've known and loved and all of this stuff. Like I think this last essay again, was one of my favorites because it really tied in everything and like really made sense of what his purpose, his reason for writing and being here.
And I think it also kind of, you know, clarifies like when we read what that is about, you know, like when we really kind of engage with the story, why that feels so urgent and why that feels so important. And that kind of act that you have as a reader to read something and be very moved by it and then try to find the next person and say, like, you must read this. And I think it is, it's kind of like born from that urgency of being aware that our time is so limited and that stories can breathe so much space into that time. And just like really make us better and just change us in ways that are surprising. And then we just like want to share that with everyone.
Yeah. My personal life mission is pressing really good books into people's hands, right? Like that feeling. And like the right book into the right person's hand to like unlock something, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. This was great. Oh my gosh. Thank you for doing this with me. I like the book more now after talking to you about
it.
And I like the book. I just, it's not a book for me, I think is what it was. Like, I love, I can respect it. I can understand it. Like, I can go with it, but it doesn't like tap into my core being in the way that I think if you're a writer, it you probably will, feel like it, full. Like,
it taps into all of the parts.
Yeah, exactly. Ingrid, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you so much. I loved having all of these conversations with you. This was so lovely.
Same, same, same. And everybody else, everybody else, listen to the end of the episode to find out next month book club pick, and we will see you in the stacks. All right, everyone, that does it for us this week. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you again to Ingrid Rojas Contreras for returning to the show. And now I can officially announce our book club pick for the month of September. It is The Trees by Percival Everett. It's a literary thriller that explores the legacy of lynching in the United States. I could not be more excited. If you listen to next week's episode, you'll find out who our guest will be for the September 28th discussion of The Trees. If you love the show and want inside access to it, head to patreon.com/thestacks to join the Stacks Pack. Make sure you're subscribed to The Stacks wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, be sure to leave a rating and a review. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media, at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. This episode of The Stacks was edited by Christian Duenas with production assistance from Lauren Tyree. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tegirigis. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.